Good afternoon. We're delighted to see you here at Brookings Institution. My name is Dennis Wilder. I'm a visiting fellow here at the John L. Thornton China Center. I was on the National Security Council for the last 5 years, but I'm delighted now to be in the academic world. As you know, today's session is on the impact of religion in China. I must admit this is a subject that I was grateful to be able to moderate on because I think it's one of the more fascinating and understudied subjects in China today. Current state of religion in China is, of course, controversial. Not even possible, I don't think, to get a real handle on how many believers there are in China. Chinese government holds that there are about 100 million believers. But there's a rather famous study that was done by a professor at Huadong Teachers University in 2005 where he did a study and believed that the number of believers may be 300 million in China, which of course would be triple the number that the Chinese government now suggests. But whatever that figure may be, I think there's no question that there has been a religious reawakening in China and that faith-based organizations from all over the world are now actively engaged with Chinese believers in a variety of ways. I was particularly interested in the response of faith-based organizations to the Sichuan earthquake last year. There were many anecdotal stories of Christian groups and Buddhist groups going into the earthquake area and assisting the people. So there's no question that religion is having an impact in China. The question is how. The question is how great an impact. And we've tried to bring together today a group of eminent scholars, all of whom have studied different aspects of religion in China, to share a few thoughts with us. What I thought we'd do is give each of them about 10 or 15 minutes to give you a few opening remarks. And then we'll open the floor to discussion. Let me first introduce to you Dr. Carol Hamrin, who is a research professor at George Mason University and a senior associate with the Global China Center in Charlottesville. Dr. Hamrin has extensive experience looking at culture and religion in China. In fact, she's just published a book that I commend to all of you called Salt and Light. I had a chance to look at it this weekend. It's a book on Chinese Christians and the impact that these Christians had in the early 20th century. And it is absolutely fascinating and really untold stories. And perhaps Dr. Hamrin will explain how she's doing some of this research. She did serve for, I think, 25 years in the State Department, doing some of the most innovative analysis there on these kinds of issues. And so let me hand it over to Carol to begin our discussion.
Thank you, Dennis. When Dennis contacted me and asked me to be here today, I said yes immediately. And I was glad my calendar was free because one of the reasons I left government in 2000 to do more research and writing was I thought that inside the Beltway, we focus almost entirely on politics and economics in the U.S.-China relationship, and we really don't understand the depth and the creativity in unofficial U.S.-China ties of all kinds, social and cultural relations, and the importance of that. So I've really learned a lot in recent years in doing more research in that whole area. And so I was really glad that this seminar would open up the conversation about these topics. I really have learned that the rebirth of civil society in China today includes religious organizations and their offshoots, various charitable, educational, medical institutions. And this shouldn't be surprising to anyone. These have always been a central part of American civil society since Tocqueville first looked at our civil society and discovered all these religious and faith-based organizations there. And they were a big part of the original development of China's early modern civil society 100 years ago, which I've been doing research on. And these 10 Chinese that I've written about in this first book really were pioneers of the modern professions in China, started some of the first China-based offices for international NGOs as well as Chinese NGOs in China. And so there is a legacy, there is a history, and that's why the title Reawakening is a good one to use here. I thought I'd start by talking about the dynamics of this huge growth of religion in post-Mao China. You've all read different things about the numbers, but why is this happening is a big question, I think, on our minds. And what I've tried to do is view it as a broader context. I see it as a result of social and cultural pluralization that has been an integral part of the economic reform and opening up of China. In a sense, Chinese society has been outgrowing socialism in all fields, despite the continued occupation of the high ground or the key points by the party state. And so, just as there are private businesses in the economic market sector adding competitive pressures that help improve the state-owned sector, so there's a growing market for private and quasi-independent nonprofit associations, again, providing healthy competition for the large gongos, government-organized NGOs, so that they're improving due to the competition with these other more independent groups. Well, similarly, I think there's what you might call a religious market of private, non-governmental belief systems and independent spiritual communities, which add healthy competition to the state-authorized orthodoxy of socialist culture and to the state-endorsed monopoly associations for the various religions. So, in a sense, I would say that you could view these all as global markets. They're not just Chinese markets. There are international entities involved in all of these sectors, in the religious sector and social sector, as well as in the economy. So China, under globalization, is going to continue to move in this direction of the recovery, resurgence of civil society. Dennis mentioned the debate about how many religious believers there are. This 100 million total that has been given out as the official number dates back to 1994 when the UN religious rapporteur visited China last. So that's one good argument for getting the religious rapporteur back to China. We'll get some more numbers that we can work with. The Academy of Social Science Deputy Director of the Institute of World Religion has now used these numbers from the survey in Shanghai that cite 300 million. Mm-hmm. So there's a growing officialdom to that number. This would not include folk religion or folk faith, but rather the authorized five religions in China. And within this general number, probably the largest and fastest growing groups would be Buddhist and Protestant. And current guesstimates for the numbers of Protestants are 75 to 100 million, with unregistered groups being three or four times the numbers in the official monopoly association for Protestants. I'd say it's important to note that pluralism spawns not only growth, but competition, which can shade into conflict. So this is not all a positive picture. There's conflict and competition within each religious group, as there's a diversity of sects or denominations developing. There's conflict or competition, healthy or not, between religious groups. I think this is one important reason for the state attempt to continue to keep the numbers down and keep people in place, not allowing cross-provincial proselytizing and so forth. They're very fearful of conflict between ethnic and religious groups. But for the most part, I think the trends we've seen in China so far have been healthy competition. I'll mention some of the positive influences of Christians, Protestant Christians, that I've studied on society. Two decades ago, the Chinese Protestant Church was made up of what people called the women, the elderly, and the poor, sort of the marginalized groups in society. But now there are Christians in every walk of life, in every social stratum, in every profession. And what is now called the emerging church is made up of young, highly educated urban professionals, mostly Protestant and mostly evangelical. They meet in small fellowship groups that are networked together for resources, including lay pastors. They position themselves, though, not as underground, but as open churches engaged with society. And in fact, I think with the increasing social and geographic mobility in China, all the various wings of the Protestant church are engaging more and more with society. And these religious organizations provide a sense of community belonging, mutual support for life's crises, and they also spur humanitarian efforts to fill major gaps in China's social services under capitalism, such as schools and churches for migrant workers in the cities. The most recent email I got just before I came this morning was from a friend who recently met a blind man who was in bed for nearly 2 years with depression and physical ailments. But his Christian friends talked him into coming out of isolation, and he's now working on developing software to turn Chinese print into Braille. She also visited a school run by Christians that provides therapy and education for autistic children and support for their parents. So these are kind of the gaps in society where people really are not getting state help and need help. And when I was advising on a project in China for training leaders of NGOs, there were many of these kinds of small mom-and-pop mutual help associations springing up and getting training and getting foreign funding. So far, these groups are not allowed to get domestic funding very easily. Well, with this growing numbers and influence of religious organizations in China, there's been a major shift in social attitudes toward religion, which I think explains a lot of the growth into the elites as well as the marginal groups in society. And this starts with individuals and their families. I've heard of several people working in campus outreach groups here in the States who say that Chinese students arrive on campus having been told by their families to explore religion while they're here and decide whether the family should become Buddhist or Christian. So there's an interest rather than an opposition to this kind of development. Retirees come from China to visit their families who are scholars or students here in the States and get baptized and go back to China within 6 months to join or start up new churches. The academic scholars who study religion are proliferating in number and sophistication and basically have exonerated the missionaries from the charge of cultural imperialism despite the official line, which is still quite negative. These are just examples of some of the influence on society. I've written a longer essay about this, which is on the AEI website under their Tocqueville in China project, if you're interested. Well, I would say that in turn, this kind of growth in numbers and influence by religious groups in China have prompted a gradual policy adaptation to reality. For most people, it's too little, too late, or too slow, but there is change underway. In the 80s, after failing to totally suppress religion during the Mao era, the party returned to the 1950s Soviet model in policy and structure for dealing with religion. The goal remained to maintain state dominance over society and to bring about the eventual demise of religion. But there was a willingness to wait for what was thought to be the natural outcome of modernization, that there would be no more religion once people were educated and scientific in their thinking and had enough material resources. The methods used for this approach to religion were controlled by the United Front system at the top over key social groups through setting up monopoly associations in different functional systems. And so these groups, which all belong to the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference at various levels, are the official monopoly associations for youth, Communist Youth League, for women, Women's Federation, for labor, the Trade Union Federation, the five patriotic religious associations, and then many different kinds of professional associations for scientists and technology people. It's China Association of Science and Technology. And then, of course, there are business and entrepreneur associations. And all of these were set up originally as kind of top-down command and control mechanisms under the residual Leninist system, which still prevails in China. I would say that this kind of approach, especially in religion and labor affairs, is way behind the curve of opening up to foreign ties seen in other arenas. For example, missionaries are still labeled as cultural imperialists, even as economic imperialists are welcomed back to China. All the companies that used to do business in China, from AIG to Standard Oil, there's a Standard Oil museum now you can visit in China. So control over the social sector is behind the curve in the economic sector in terms of revamping state-owned or state-organized institutions and welcoming private institutions and allowing more and more international exchange in these arenas. But still, there's been a trend to open up society and culture as well. In the 90s, for example, there was a major opening up of academic studies of religion. At first, scholars were just supposed to study religion anywhere out there but China. They weren't allowed to talk about religion in China. But that's changing. There are internal surveys that have been done by Chinese scholars that I think will gradually be coming out so that we have more data to work with in understanding the situation in China. There was also an opening up to both international and domestic faith-based organizations working in relief work, disaster relief, and anti-poverty work, especially in the southwest part of China. Under the Develop the West program in the previous five-year plan, where the focus was on poverty alleviation. So many, many international NGOs have begun work in China and then spread to other poverty areas of China. And these include faith-based organizations. One would be World Vision, for example, that has worked in China for decades, and also Christian organizations. So when the earthquake happened, all these groups that showed up to help with the reconstruction and are still there helping with rebuilding were local. I mean, they were out there in the Southwest and had developed good relations with local authorities and were right on the ground, and so among the first responders. Well, in the 2000s, there's been further adaptation by the state. First of all, and most important, in 2001, the new 10-year policy finally admitted religion is here to stay. It's part of any society, including Chinese society, including socialist society. And I think the policy since then has been developing toward what I would call discrimination and competition with these civic and religious groups, trying to make sure that the social sector serves state interests, so that people who are teaching atheism or spreading socialist culture have to compete with all these other groups with their own set of beliefs. And there's been an opening up of social services because that's where the state can see religious groups can be most helpful to its own agenda. And I think, though, that this has been tempered by a focus on national security in a lot of sectors, but especially in the religious sector, influenced by September 11, which occurred, 9/11 occurred right during the middle of this conference that was reviewing the previous 10 years and coming up with a new 10-year policy. So there's a special harsh treatment of ethnic minorities in the West, Northwest and Southwest, who have religious culture, Tibetans and Uyghurs, most notably. There's also a special repressive attention to anyone who tries to set up any sort of cross-provincial or national-level association for religious groups that's outside the control of the state. And so some of the legal advocates who've been defending groups in the court who set up a national association of legal advocates, or the National House Church Alliance leader, the people who are setting up such organizations have come under tremendous abusive treatment as a result. I would say that there's a possible rethinking of religious policy underway now. There are some signs of that. We can discuss it more later. It may be part of the natural 5-year, 10-year planning process, which we're right in the middle of now, people putting together the next 5-year and 10-year plans in China for policies across the board. Well, in the discussion area, I'd like to talk a little bit about the importance of paradigm in shaping policy of both the Chinese government and the U.S. government. But I don't have more time to go into that now. But I think there are some ways in which the U.S. media and academics and the government sort of reinforce a mindset in the Chinese government that thinks of religion as the exception to the rule, that the norm is kind of secular thinking. Religion is a leftover from a non-modern era, that modernity involves secularization rather than pluralization. And I think sometimes we fit into that by asking about religious rights for ethnic minorities, which the Chinese government sees as an exception to the rule, which is most Han people are socialists and atheists, not religious believers. And recently I was encouraged by Secretary Clinton's statement before her trip to Asia, calling for religious freedom for all Chinese, not just for, you know, certain groups in China. I think another way we tend to reinforce the Chinese mindset is by politicizing religion so that the government, the media, academics in China tend to look at the political aspects of religion in China, following an assumption that there's a contentious relationship, and that's the only relationship between state and society or state and religion. And this provides evidence to the Chinese government that there's a hidden political agenda behind American support for religious groups in China. So I think it's very important to get a new paradigm that looks at religion as a very natural and important part of civil society everywhere in both countries, and to come at it from a different angle. I'll stop there.
Great. Thank you, Carol. Mm-hmm. That was a tremendous overview to the subject. I'm sure you'll have questions for Carol, but if we can hold them and let our other speakers to talk. Our second speaker today is Dr. Saran Shakya. He is a renowned professor of Tibetan studies at the University of British Columbia in Canada. So he's come a long way today to be with us, and we really appreciate that. He was born in Lhasa. He has his PhD in Tibetan studies, and he's written numerous books on Tibet and Tibetan culture. In fact, his book, The Dragon in the Land of Snows, is regarded as a must-read on the history of modern Tibet. Dr. Shakya.
Thank you. Thank you. As the previous speaker mentioned about the transition in Chinese government policy towards religion and status of religion in China, in China there is what are called orthodox consensus about religion. The phrase orthodox consensus I borrowed from Anthony Giddens, the British sociologist. He, in that, both the party and the Chinese intellectuals and among the sort of educated Chinese, there is a view about religion. That is to see religion as a negative influence left over from the past, something that has to be overcome if China is to become great or modernized. That obsession with modernity, modern, and somehow religious is always equated with the past and something backward, and something has to be transcended in this. So in the since founding of PRC, or since May 5th movement, Chinese people's struggle has been to overcome superstition, religion, and the past, and to create modern China. So there's this orthodox consensus shared by many Chinese intellectuals, writers, artists, even today. That sort of view dominating Chinese sort of intellectual discussion and discourse places religion as something of negative, something to be embarrassed about, something that is not really, something that gone wrong in history, that has to be overcome. But nevertheless, as this religion is evidently here, it hasn't been eradicated. Despite the attempt during the Cultural Revolution and past government anti-religious propaganda, still hasn't really worked. And we don't know exact numbers of religious followers in China, but there are great many, and religion is resurfacing in the forefront of Chinese people's consciousness and thinking. And if you look at China in, say, situation in Tibet, Xinjiang, China, I think there's a different trajectory of reemergence of religion. When, if you consider religion in Tibet or Xinjiang, I would call the reemergence is related to the collective. It's part of the collective identity. It's not so much of an individual-based faith or private faith transition to sort of finding private faith in religion. It is fundamentally to do with the collective identity. While when you look at among the great majority of Han community, the Chinese community, the revival of religion is actually very much a personal transition, personal discovery of oneself, of discovery of faith. There is a much more different experience going. When the personal and collective, it brings in a different problems for the government, and it initiates also very different kinds of government policy towards religion in that. So if you look at the, Tibet, this is reflected in Xinjiang in a very broad level from since the Deng Xiaoping's period, reform period, they have been really resurfacing religion to the forefront. It is inconceivable for Tibetans not to think themselves as Buddhists. And it has become, religion has so important part of their identity and their sort of landscape. So what you see in Tibet in the first sort of decade of the Deng Xiaoping's reform period, what I call the project of resalvaging, that is to restore religion to where it was, because the destruction that suffered under the Cultural Revolution meant religion has to be archaeologically dug up and rebuilt. So that means the rebuilding of the monastery, reprinting of religious texts. It's almost sort of a collective will, sort of archaeologically, sort of bringing everything back to the surface that was done and making it once more visible. And it is not just a question of sort of Buddhism or religion per se. It was seen as a very, very fundamental aspect of their identity and their land. So this way, the religion was reviving Tibet. The whole religious revival was the revival of Tibet itself. That sort of, so you don't have that sort of similar trend, sort of reemergence of Chinese Buddhism or reemergence of Christianity in China. It wasn't seen in that same collective of reassertion of Chinese or recreation of Chinese identity, Han identity in China. It was much more of a personal policy. And in Tibet, this collective identity became a very problematic to the authority, where the government policy in attitude to religion is to see, willing to tolerate religion as something of a private experience. as long as individuals were willing to accept religion as a purely private experience and domesticated, party was willing to tolerate. And this was in Tibet, it was no longer that they did not want to confine religion just to the private space or to the to their domestic sphere. They saw this religion as an expression of the collective. And the, in Tibetan Buddhism, is not something that you pray privately or something can be done domestically as an individual, purely based private faith. It is a collective expression. Religion has to be collective. That is the establishment of the monastery, teaching of religious, transmission of religious knowledge. It has to be collective. It's not just an individual faith. Then another problem with religion, the way the government saw it, is a private discovery, where there was a fundamental issue of transmission of knowledge and authenticity and legitimacy. This was very problematic. How do you transmit religious knowledge? Who is authorized to teach religion? And who is sanctioned to bless that, sanctify the religious teaching? So this was a fundamental problem. What the party sees as the legitimizing authority in terms of religion, they do not have the legitimacy in terms of the followers. Followers do not legitimize the institutions established by the parties. So in Tibetan Buddhism, the transmission of knowledge is very important. It has to be legitimized through tradition. Say, who recognizes a lama? You know, who recognizes a teaching? It's not a matter of just learning by reading. It has to be transmitted correctly according to the rules of orthodoxy. So that kind of problem, that the party was willing to see this as something that has to be reformed. The religion has to be transformed into something of private experience, and the legitimacy of transmission knowledge was not a problem for the party. It's something can be taught in universities or it can be taught in Lama institutions set up by the government. But from the practitioner's point of view, these do not have a legitimacy. So the fundamental problem that party was, while it was willing to tolerate reemergence of religion as a purely private experience, but was not willing to express its sort of collective authority and its collective assertion, not only in terms of identity, but also in terms of transmission of the knowledge and the legitimacy of the religion. That religious practice can be only legitimized by the party. But from that is not, is in the eyes of practitioner, is something is not legitimate. This made me sort of think in terms of what is the sort of the, fundamental problem that is emerging in China in terms of religion, is what is the situation in Tibet. Is and if you look at the sort of history of religion and state in Europe and America, and I sort of see much more similarity between the United States, what happened, and in Europe. For example, in Europe, if you look at the is the notion of secularization of religious freedom emerges out of the states that need to protect them from religious institution. You know, the state and the secular institutions had to be protected from the intrusion of Catholic Church, the Pope, and religious authority. While in the United States, the founding fathers of the United States, emerges out of need to protect religious groups from interference by the state. You know, of course, most religious important groups in America emerges out of the dissenters, and therefore they wanted secularism to protect the religious group from states. So similarly, today what's happening in Tibet is much more of the monasteries are trying to stop the sort of state intrusions in the monastery. It is that they are very little interested in, say, for example, Buddhists don't make a collective statement about one-child policy. They don't say, we oppose from moral grounds, we oppose this state policy. They do not make statements or argue about societal moralities, about what should be the correct laws or what should be instituted in terms of, in fact, they're very reluctant to participate in that kind of debate. What they care is what happens in the religious organizations and in the monasteries, confines of religious territories. So this is the point where the monks think, why should party interfere in the appointment of the abbots? Now, why should party have a say? Why can't the monks just elect the party? Why should party should be worried about how we teach our religion? So they, in a way, this protest in Tibet and the conflict of religion is really the religious groups in China are trying to protect the state interfering in the religious practices. In fact, many times I would say it is the state often politicized religion rather than religion trying to influence policy of the states. In a state, through by nature of the control and regulation, politicized the religious organization much more. And the state does this partly to fear that although religion is seen as an inevitable aspect of human society, it has to be tolerated, but there's another dimension in Chinese government policy that it has to be contained. Religion has to be contained. It can be a virus. It can be a dangerous virus which proliferates into society, and something that of containment policy has to be adopted in towards religion. And this brings up the whole question of China, limits of civil society, limits of public spheres in China. You know, this is China. And this fundamental anxiety party has about fear stems from, the very idea of Communist Party itself, in that religion re-emerges as alternative ideology, alternative paradigm for Chinese people. It is no longer the Communist Party or the Communist materialism is the main orthodox, but they are re-emerging of religion in sense. And when religion emerges, it presents as a three problem. Religions tend to be organized. They tend to meet in groups. Religions tend to have an ideology that is not communism, that is something else. And secondly, religions tend to have leaders or lamas or priests or something who is not the party secretary. So that these three aspects makes them very problematic, the Communist Party. And the religion have a potential to become genuine alternative to the Communist Party and its own structure of administration and rule in China. Question about the way religion, whether it will reemerge at the center of force in China, or it still remain in the periphery. If we say 300 million in China, that is not, it's less than 50%. It is still not a great number in terms of overall China. So and I think Chinese, the orthodox consensus will remain for many years. I think China still is assumption that religion is detrimental for China's modernization and the creation of strong China. So that orthodox consensus hasn't been broken despite the sort of reemergence of religion in China.
Thank you very much. Our third expert today is Dr. Sophie Richardson, who is Asia Advocacy Director for Human Rights Watch. She also has a new book coming out on Chinese foreign policy from Columbia University Press. I thought that Human Rights Watch was a very open organization, but she refuses to tell me the title of this book yet, so you'll have to wait to see what it is. Dr. Richardson's a graduate of University of Virginia and Oberlin College, and her writings and commentaries are often seen in U.S. and international media. Dr. Richardson.
You could maybe try having a case filed against me under the State Secrets Act in China to get the title out of me. Thanks very much for having us here. It's a little bit hard to improve on what's been said. I think just to set the stage a little bit, it may help everyone to be reminded that the Chinese Constitution does guarantee the right to believe. It does not guarantee the right to practice or to worship. And therein lies one of the main difficulties. One of the others is that some religions are recognized and tolerated, and others are not. And typically the ones that are not are the ones that are thought to be Trojan horses or vehicles for separatism, or ones that betray a certain organizational capability. And for those religions, a particular form of hostility is reserved by the central government. And this includes, as Carol and Tering have talked about, religion restrictions on who can be a member of the clergy, what they're allowed to say, how children can be educated, what can be registered as a place of worship. I want to try to end up with Carol's point about, you know, whether we can separate religion and politics in a place like China. I think, as the invitation this afternoon suggested, it's true that there is now greater latitude for some religions in China, and that we've obviously seen growing numbers of adherents, more churches, things like that. But I think that for some other groups, the growth that we see is actually in the hostility towards certain groups that will not be cowed, essentially, in trying to pursue their own religious traditions. And in that category, I would put groups like house churches, the Falun Gong, some Tibetan Buddhists, and Uyghurs. And I was actually asked to speak this afternoon specifically about Xinjiang, which hopefully I'll do well. I know there are several people here who are far more knowledgeable about Xinjiang than I, so please do correct me if I get anything wrong. For those of you who don't know, Xinjiang is a very large region in western China. It is technically an autonomous region, meaning that it should have a high degree of autonomy over the affairs in that particular province. About half of the people in the province, 10 million, are Uyghurs, a Turkic-speaking ethnic minority who follow varying degrees of Sunni Islam, the derivative of Sunni Islam. And there's a certain amount of variation even within the community in Xinjiang about how traditional, essentially, people are in their practices. I wanted to read to you, or read back to you, for those of you who were here, to hear the group of Chinese government officials who spoke last September here about religion in China. This is a comment from the representative from the China Islamic Association, which is an NGO that the Chinese government either organized or permitted to register in 2001. According to this man, after the founding of the new China, Muslims of various nationalities have gained great achievement and development in various fields of political issues, economy, and culture. In regions where Muslims are in great numbers, nationality and regional autonomy are given. The Chinese government persistently pursues a policy of, quote, ethnic equality and religious freedom. Muslims enjoy equal rights and share in the harmonious sunshine. I couldn't make that one up if I tried. We all know that the reality is really quite different for large numbers of Uyghurs, and that the central government persists in a belief that Xinjiang is a breeding ground for terrorists. I think we're all equally aware that, you know, there's a large body of international law, and indeed domestic law in China, that deals with how you would actually address real security threats. I think the real core problem in Xinjiang is that the provincial authorities and the central government persist in conflating both the practice of Islam and any expression of Uyghur nationalism essentially as a threat to national security, and therefore both are treated fairly harshly. Some of the examples of, I think, particularly intrusive religious policies, and this is where I think it gets very difficult to separate out the politics and the religion. If you work for the government in Xinjiang, either at the provincial level or even at the local level, you are not allowed to practice Islam. Period. Full stop. It is written in provincial regulations that this is forbidden. It is now extremely difficult to educate your children in Islamic traditions, even if you're doing it in the confines of your own home, which even cuts against the idea that, you know, religion is a permissible thing as long as it's kept personal or within a family. Most recently, we saw new prohibitions or regulations requiring that Uyghur men shave, but that women be forbidden from wearing headscarves, right? These are practices that really fly in the face of traditional practices in the province. It's hard to separate, I think, the growing impositions in the last couple of years from the war on terror since 2001. I think you know, for all of the efforts that the Bush administration may have made in defending the rights of some religions in China, the Uyghurs really got sold down the river. And that the Bush administration did very little to fight back against the Chinese government's co-optation of the rhetoric and the policies of the war on terror in really cracking down pretty hard on Uyghurs in that region. One of the steps we'd certainly like to see the Obama administration undo is the Bush administration's having agreed to put what's called the East Turkestan Independence Movement on the list of terrorist organizations. The very existence of ETIM continues to be hotly debated. It's very difficult to ascertain whether it even exists. The Chinese government would have you believe that it is a small but lean and mean fighting machine that's out there and going to get the central government. It has never offered up compelling evidence to suggest that that's really the case. I think one of the other problems we've tracked over the last 5 or 6 years with the rise of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization between China, Russia, and some of the other Central Asian republics are really problematic extradition practices. I mean, there's effectively no due process, and particularly when you're talking about being extradited to countries that have great enthusiasm for the use of the death penalty and a real political agenda against certain members of the Islamic clergy in that region. You know, these are particularly problematic phenomena. The presence of, I think there's 16 Uyghurs at Guantanamo Bay is also problematic. You know, the Chinese government has used those people's presence at Guantanamo as evidence that there is a real organized terrorist threat that emanates from Xinjiang, and has also occasionally pointed to the United States' unwillingness to take these people and let them resettle here as evidence that they really are terrorists. Obviously, one of the things that we'd like to see the Obama administration do is admit those people, now that they've essentially been deemed not a threat, admit them into the United States. Last year, I think, was particularly problematic in Xinjiang, particularly around the Olympics, when Uyghur separatism was designated. It's a very strange policy. You can actually go online and read it. When Uyghur separatism was actually designated as one of the greatest threats to the successful hosting of the Olympic Games. And so we saw a year-long crackdown that was geared towards eradicating the three evil forces, that's the Chinese government's term, of terrorism, religious extremism, and separatism, which in turn led to another round of very intrusive policies. One of the most recent ones about a year ago were new regulations that were, it was 23 types of illegal religious activities which prohibited praying in public or even praying at wedding ceremonies. I mean, these are policies that really cut into very personal daily religious practices that you'd have a tough time making a case for how those are real threats to national security, right, and justify the need to regulate them. It's hard to see how those kinds of policies don't further embolden some of, I think, the very small handful of people in Xinjiang who do occasionally engage in violent behavior. We saw a couple of incidents last year, although it's still quite unclear who perpetrated these attacks. Some of them were on police facilities. And for what purpose? The Chinese government, again, would have you believe that these are terrorists and separatists who were trying somehow to make the government look bad in the run-up to the Olympics or in the aftermath of the Olympics. That case has never really been very clearly proven. But it's very easy to see a real cycle here whereby the government says, you know, this behavior is a national security threat, therefore we're going to impose further restrictions. Those restrictions, I think, have really gone a long way towards polarizing the relationship in general between Uyghurs and Han Chinese in the region, who don't necessarily or who wouldn't otherwise necessarily have a problem with one another. And I think we're now seeing, both in Xinjiang and actually to some extent in Lhasa as well, a kind of real tension between ethnic groups that wasn't there 10 years ago, and that is going to be much harder in the long run to undo. Some of the steps that we as an advocacy organization would like to see taken are fairly straightforward. I mean, obviously rolling back some of the constraints on religious practices, you know, let people go to the Hajj as individuals. Don't force them to go on state-sponsored tours. Give them some control over their religious lives. But I think it's going to be very difficult to make any significant steps towards lessening that kind of hostility until we see the state take a big step back out of religion. And as Carol was suggesting, you know, once, and actually Taryn was saying too, you know, once the state gets involved in dictating who's allowed to do what and when, it's hard to take a step back, particularly, I think, in two regions where the Chinese government now has a significant sort of PR stake with the rest of the Han population in producing a certain amount of compliance and stability. And I think it's going to be very difficult to get the government to change its ways, which is quite problematic in the long run. I'll stop there.
Thanks very much. I do want to get to questions. Oh, go ahead. I do want to get to questions, but first I'm going to ask one question of the panel, which is getting to what Dr. Richardson talked about. We obviously have a very complex situation on religion in China. And the question I would have for you is, as people who have thought this through very carefully, what should foreign governments do in relation to China's religious policy? What would your recommendations be? Carol, you want to?
I think if we could move beyond the policy of highlighting abuses and violent repression. Now, when I say beyond that, I mean don't give up. It's very important, the advocacy groups getting the information out there and then governments speaking up about this, because it does work to force implementation of policy to be more cautious, at least to stay away from any opportunity for your repression to be publicized. So, but I'm saying if we could move beyond that to talk more with the Chinese about religious rights as a right for everybody in China, not just certain groups. And let me give an example of what I mean by that. I think if all the U.S. media and government talks about is house churches among Protestants in China, it fuels this sense that there must be a hidden political agenda, that the U.S. is supporting anti-government groups for political reasons. Mm-hmm. If instead we would also talk about the discrimination which the majority of Chinese Christians face, which includes intrusion into theology, you know, reconstruction of theology so that the theology better suits state purposes, and refusal to allow any Chinese Protestant group to register who doesn't have a pastor trained in a Chinese seminary. So even if you have a seminary degree from anywhere else in the world, you're not a legitimate church pastor. I mean, this kind of intrusion and forcing religion to wear tight shoes. You know, there's one website allowed for Chinese Protestants. There's one publishing house. There's one journal. You know, this is the kind of, you know, quotas on training schools and training materials and so forth that constrains religious freedom of all Chinese people. If we focused on the broader picture and used international norms, not American norms, for what religion should look like, the international regimes that China has signed onto and should be implementing as a member of the UN are very good. I mean, those norms would protect religious freedom. And I think if we could reform international instruments so that they're much more effective in promoting religious rights everywhere, but including in China, I think there's a lot that could be done.
Sorry?
Agree. But sometimes actually we also need to have a better understanding of what exactly happens in China. For example, we think Chinese government attempt to ban beard with Uyghurs and wearing of headscarf, hijabs in school. Then France faced the same problem. You know, and we don't say French government abuses freedom of religion and France is horrible, you know. Of course, we do say France is horrible, but... and, you know, certain things. We think Turkish government is good. They're trying to stop university students coming to universities with religious symbols or wearing hijab. And that is sin. So, religion, of course, dealing with religion, there's always a very problem about... We think Gandhi and Martin Luther is wonderful. They interfere in politics and social reform. Yet then the other Christian groups who are trying to interfere in the politics, they say, oh, terrible, religion is bad. You know, they interfere in the state, who wants to ban stem cell research. So there is a fundamental problem anyway in the universal problems of religion and politics that is there. So some way, actually, we also need to appreciate that sort of problem. And Chinese government face the same problem in that. One of the things the West can do is, I feel, it's very important to say, China, these are problems we face everywhere. It's how you deal with these problems. It's not about, of course there's problems of religious institution. How do you monitor them? How do you get them registered? How do you have a charitable organization which register as charity? How do you get them monitor their finances? You know, so you have to, so it's not to be immediate reaction where they sort of, it has to be banned. Or negative, but it's something way of through legislative means of control and can be tolerated, these things. So I think to some extent our presentation of the problem of religion in China has to be also very clear and precise and why this problem is faced. It's not to just look at it in a very centralized way of this is a problem, religion. When in Tibet also... Of course, all Communist Party members cannot be religious. You cannot, if the party says, if you're a member of the party, you cannot be going to the Buddhist temple and still being sort of sending your children. You cannot. I mean, then when people complain that to me, I said, leave Communist Party. If you find, you can't be both, be Communist Party member, work in the Communist institution, then you want to also be religious. So, certain problem is there inherent, and this is one of the problems is about Chinese history, where China has institutional history of how China has adapted since founding of PRC. China hasn't been able to negotiate these things very well. You know, in the Republican Party, it doesn't say if you're religious, you can't be Republican or Democratic Party. You know, but the Communist Party does say that you can't be. So it's a somehow we also need to have a better appreciation and presentation. That's why Chinese get so upset. Because when you have the problem, you are dealing with it, but we have the same problem, you accuse of denial of freedom of religion.
Again, it's hard to improve on that. Anecdotally, it may be worth mentioning that I think the only response we've ever actually gotten to anything we've ever written about Xinjiang from provincial authorities was late last year when we sent... some short commentary on the headscarf issue and included in it work that my colleagues in our Eastern and Central Europe division had done on the headscarf issue in Turkey and in, is it France or Germany?
France.
Thank you. The response wasn't a great one, but it was at least an acknowledgement, you know, that hadn't been there before. And, you know, it said something like, you know, we appreciate your sharing your views on how these issues are dealt with elsewhere. So I do think there's certainly something to be said for trying to speak about these issues from a bit more of a global perspective. Of course, for a government, that's harder to do. You know, I'm certainly a big fan of Carol's point about trying to be consistent across religions and not just, you know, placing disproportionate emphasis on one or two to the near total exclusion of the others. But if you line up, you know, if you assemble all of the U.S. government rhetoric from the last 8 or 10 years about religion in China, boy, it is hard work to find much supportive language there about Uyghurs and Islam. You know, there's a lot there about Christians and house churches, and it's a kind of inconsistency, I think, that the Chinese government really notices. I think one of the other real challenges, two other quick challenges. One is that you know, the EU countries have a very different approach to the issue of religion and promoting it internationally, and so I think there's always quite a gulf between what the U.S. is saying and what European countries are saying. And last but not least, I think the U.S. government sort of, you know, changes its mind every 3 days about whether it's going to talk about religion and the political dimensions of it, you know, that religion carries with it. It's about organizing. It's about providing alternative leadership. It's about another mobilizing, motivating ideology. And, you know, my experience has been that U.S. officials sort of want to talk about religion as a force that sits in this little box and has no potentially problematic consequences for the Chinese government, which, of course, in a way is a real non-starter, because to them it's all about the organizing capability and alternative leadership. And to have a conversation in those very sort of restrained ways, I think, sort of ends the conversation before it even begins. And so I think governments need to get smarter about how they're going to talk to the Chinese government, but why they shouldn't worry so much or be so fearful of that. Maybe the problem is that they are fearful of that and there's not a whole lot we can do. But talking about it in a very desiccated way, I think, doesn't do much.
Great. Okay. If I can ask you to wait until the microphone comes to ask your questions. And if you would, identify yourself and perhaps your affiliation, that would be helpful to us. The gentleman right here.
Thank you. Radio Free Asia Karma. Thanks for bringing Dr. Shaka, because it's rare to have native Tibetans speaking about all the things going wrong in China and by extension in Tibet. We know that of all the ills and the PR damage that China has suffered for long has much to do with the fall of Tibet and the revival of spiritualism or religion, without mentioning Buddhism, which of course is a major factor, everyone in this town knows. I'm tempted to ask Dr. Shakya the impact of the personal charismatic ideas of the peace-loving Dalai Lama, who we are taught to believe is the major thorn in Chinese society. We do know different faiths are there in China, but perhaps maybe because I'm a Tibetan. Sorry for that. But our belief is the Dalai Lama is doing the damage to the Chinese people. This is what, at least in terms of religion. So in this so-called religious revival in China, what do you think is the impact of the Dalai Lama? And is Dalai Lama still possibly a key to solving China's civilian problems? Dr. Shakya?
The situation has completely changed since March 10, March 14 last year, and the image of Dalai Lama. If you look in China, what is the most popular books for sale? What are the bestseller books on China? Mm-hmm. At present, the bestseller book is in English translation called Tibet Code. It's based on Da Vinci Code, but it's now in Chinese called Tibet Code. It's just a bestseller. The next bestseller is another book. Bestseller is Sergei Rimitz's book on living and dying. Tibetan religious book constantly, or mystical elements like Losa Rampa's book, this appear predominantly in Chinese bestseller lists, very popular. This indicates to me there's some sort of mystical Shangri-La interest in there. In fact, many of my Chinese friends who live in Lhasa, now they all are sort of read, there's sort of Jakura's Dharma Bum sort of trip is going on in Tibet. There is a very mystical interest in Tibet. And that sense that Dalai Lama as a person is something is begin to be introduced. But as a Tibet as a whole, there has been influence in China as a whole. But since last year, the situation has completely changed. And I think this has almost, you can say, government has engineered this very successfully, well done, and there is a very sort of strong resentment of the Tibetans in Chinese popular perception. Almost it has become impossible for Chinese writers or artists who used to work with the Tibetan themes to be a bit successful in China. Tibetan. So it's a very different, it's complete. In fact, Dalai Lama now has no sort of much standing among Chinese populace, public. Of course, there may be one or a few percentage of Buddhists or who may respect, but not only the his sort of decline is not only affected the so the Chinese in PRC, but all the Chinese-speaking world, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Singapore, Malaysia, anywhere you have, there has been detriment because it's that was the Chinese government successfully managed to make that transition by essentially Tibetans being portrayed as has propensity for violence, who are anti-Chinese, who are absolutely sort of bent on destroying China. So this image has really resonated with the Chinese people as a whole. So this is the situation. Situation about 19, before that was sort of very different.
I think gentlemen way in the back. We won't penalize you for sitting all the way back.
Richard Finney, also with Radio Free Asia. Tsering Shapyak, a growing number of Han Chinese are practicing Tibetan Buddhism beyond the superficial level of just being attracted to mystical things. Do you have any sense of the numbers involved, and how does this fit into that paradigm of collective identity versus individual expression of faith that you were talking about?
Tibetan Buddhism, one of the things is that Tibetan Buddhism has never been foreign to Chinese. Tibetan Buddhism has always been a very important part of Chinese life. If you look from the Ming period and to Yuan, to Qing, any dynasty, actually, Tibetan Buddhism has played a very, very significant role in Chinese cultural life and tradition. You just have to go to Wu Tashen. Look at the symbols that there. It's both Tibetan and Chinese symbols mixed completely in harmonious way. It is a thing. So one of the things what I find quite sad is the attack on religion, and particularly on Tibetan religion. Chinese populist imagination and intellectual history, they have erased that connection. The link between Tibetan Buddhism as being aspect of Chinese cultural life to being made into totally alien aspect of Chinese life. That is, in fact, a severing of historical ties that exists in the past. And also, politicization of that ties has been negative. When you look at it, almost throughout the Ming period to now, the Tibet, hundreds and hundreds of Han Chinese have stayed in Tibetan monastery and learning and studying. It was a normal practice, both in all of the imperial courts, to have a Tibetan language library. Imperial prince and princesses learn Tibetan language. You know, in the Qing court, the prince and princess, it's compulsory to learn Tibetan. So certain aspects, this has been lost. So the Han Chinese interest in Tibet is not something recent, historically has been. In fact, a very interesting thing. If you go to San Francisco, America, you go from Vancouver down to San Francisco, you look at all the old Chinese temples that were found. First thing you notice on all the gates and inside the decoration are Tibetan writings. Mm. And you will only now find this in North America or Europe. You will not find that in China. You know, and this is sort of like a surprise. And this when I took my Chinese students teaching, and I took them, I said, what writing are these? And they say Sanskrit, Indian, and so on. And I said, it's Tibetan. And then they are shocked. And I said, look, when the building was built, 1905. Mm-hmm. So the Chinese and Tibetan know about each other. It's not, we are not alien to each other. It's life, that was.
Young lady here.
Kaylin Ford. I'm an editor with the Falun Dafa Information Center. I had a question for Sophie. You mentioned some of the religious groups that have not sort of been given increased leeway and instead face varying degrees of persecution. My question's about the possibilities for reconciliation, specifically with the Falun Gong, which I represent. For those who don't know, it's a Qigong discipline, self-identifies as belonging to the Buddhist school, enjoyed a meteoric rise to popularity in the 1990s and was then banned in 1999 and subject to sort of a Dozong struggle campaign by the Chinese government to eradicate it. To this day, continues to represent a very, very large portion of re-education through labor camp population, of Chinese torture cases, and yet continues to sort of survive and even thrive in China. So given that there's sort of this, how would you describe it, sort of a deadlock, that Falun Gong refuses to go away, and yet the Chinese government refuses to sort of back down, what are the possibilities for the future of that relationship? It's directed to Sophie, but anyone who has insights would be welcome.
Wow. I wish I could be more optimistic, but, you know, I mean, if you, I mean, think about what Tsering was just talking about and, you know, where a relationship between a government and a religion or Tibetans and Han Chinese that had once been, you know, consistent and positive and nobody had a problem with it, but now for very political purposes has been literally written out of the history books. You know, I don't think it bodes well. And I think especially to the extent that, you know, I think the central government's issue with the Falun Gong primarily has been its organizational capacity. You know, having 10,000 people show up on your doorstep unannounced is a little bit frightening for anybody, but particularly when you're a moderately paranoid government that likes to keep control on things, it's deeply unnerving. I don't think there's necessarily an ideological complaint there, but mostly an organizational one. So it's really hard to imagine, particularly, you know, with communities like Uyghurs and Tibetans and the Falun Gong, where the central government has now invested such energy, I think, and so much of its and spent so much time justifying its own policies on the basis of demonizing these communities or finding problems with them or suggesting why they're bad for the country or opposed to the Han or ungrateful. Awfully hard to back down from that. Awfully hard. I wish I could give you a more optimistic answer. Maybe you guys can, but
I was just going to repeat my sense that the Chinese government has shifted from equal suppression, sort of like Deng Xiaoping said, socialism is not shared pauperism. You know, there's a let some get rich sooner. Well, I think the policy has shifted to favoring certain groups and in order to help continue suppressing other groups. And evidence of this would be state sponsorship of international convocations of religious leaders in Buddhism, non-Tibetan Chinese Buddhism, which, you know, reinforces the post-49 effort to give leadership in Buddhism in the official association to non-Tibetan Buddhists. And the same thing for Taoism. You know, an international conference on Taoism to, for the first time, to kind of, you know, promote that as an indigenous Chinese religion. Probably these are part and parcel of an effort to minimize the influence of Qigong, various Qigong groups. And so I think if advocacy groups and the media paid more attention to discrimination that can be more subtle than suppression, you know, to identify these kinds of trends and make it public that there's no equal playing field here for guaranteed religious freedoms that China's signed on to.
Mr. Chen Li.
Yeah, my name is Chen Li, and I'm a senior fellow at here, China Center. And first, thank you all for very thoughtful remarks. I think my question related to the generational distribution of religious believers. And I think it directs to all of you. Could you comment whether the younger generation is more religious or less religious among Uyghur, Tibetan, and Han Chinese, or different religious groups like Islamic and Tibetan and Taoism or Buddhism or Christianity and etc.? Thank you.
Let's start down there.
I'm out of my depth on this, except for
I mean, one thing we always assume Tibet is sort of a unified in Buddhism and its essential. Actually, within the Tibet, there's a great deal of diversities of debate and views are emerging. In fact, there's a very strong, apart from the sort of hardline Communist Party member, there is a very strong in publication and in writing that many younger intellectuals, Tibetans, they are very opposed to religion. They imbibe the sort of May 5th movement sort of ideology that religion is bad. Tibet, to recover, we have to eradicate religious influences. It's too bad Tibet has some too many monks. You know, we need more people out of the monasteries. So there is a strong, among young intellectuals, and they write books, they publish articles, there's a very strong intellectual tradition which is critical of Buddhism in Tibet. The second groups that are emerging within younger generation is Christianity is making inroad into Tibetan areas for the first time in history. In fact, when I travel there, I meet many young Tibetans who say they are Christians. They are influenced through the Chinese universities. They met missionaries. So there's small pockets, but that's not big. But there are pockets of this diversity of markets, as Carol mentioned, is emerging within Tibet. And Tibet also, there's Islam. There's a tiny minority of Islams in Lhasa, particularly. They also have different views. So in fundamentally, Tibet, there is, say, as I said, Buddhism in Tibet has a collective thing. It's to do with identity. So almost it is becoming an issue of a collective that we have to be Buddhist to be Tibetan. Intellectually, what the debate among this, those who support Buddhism and those who are advocate against Buddhism and saying we have to modernize, it seems to be those who say, defend the religion, it said, okay, if we discard Buddhism in Tibet and we become modern, then what makes us Tibetan? What is different us from any Han or anything? Therefore, without Buddhism, we have no Tibet. So Buddhism has to be practiced and it has to be protected. And those who intellectuals who write against religion say, no, Buddhism is the very thing which is destroying Tibet. And they say Buddhism is as alien as communism, but the Buddhism is came from India. So there is quite a vibrant debate within Tibet on this issue.
Carol, do you want to talk about it?
I think this would be a great topic for research. Maybe you can promote some. But I think it's very hard to quantify this. My sense from just reading and talking to people is that the group of Chinese that at first were more open to Christianity were those who maybe are 40 to 60 now, who've been disillusioned first by the Cultural Revolution experience they had, and then by the collapse of world communism and Tiananmen 20 years ago. And these were people who were raised to have in their minds a kind of universal worldview that explained everything. And so that was missing. And so they see in Christianity a sort of complementary to that. And people thought for a while that the younger generation who have been raised in the reform period, who've become part of the middle class, who have cars and cell phones and, you know, are into materialism, would no longer have interest in religion. But I think that that's not proven to be the case, really. That, for example, during the SARS crisis in 2003, this younger urban group was really endangered and affected. It wasn't out there somewhere. It was really something they had to fear, and it sort of reminded them of their mortality. material things aren't going to solve all problems. And so there was kind of a surge of interest around that time. And as young people become get married, get out into the job market, and start to raise families, there's a lot of younger, you know, young professional couples who are really struggling with how to raise their children, how to keep their marriage together against the odds of increasing divorce and juvenile delinquency in China, who have, you know, turned to religion and Protestantism in particular, perhaps, for answers to some of these problems. Protestantism is a little bit different in that it when people leave their home ties in the village or the ethnic group and develop a more international identity, it seems to be something that's easier to fit into as something modern and global.
Sir.
Thank you. Thank you for a very insightful panel. I have a question that's near and dear to me here. I think in looking at all the panelists here, at one time or another, each of you have written about the consistent but often arbitrary repression that often leads to a sense of self-censorship on the part of Chinese citizens, academics, as well as institutions. And I'd like to direct this question particularly to Carol, but anybody can answer. To what extent does your impression of self-censorship impact the objectivity and accuracy in terms of gathering research on the subject, say, such as religion? Thank you.
Oh, so I should pass on the last one, so I've got to answer this one. That's a hard question to answer, Jim. I mean, you know, the way we do research entails a lot of time either trying to speak directly to people who themselves have been the victims of abuses. I mean, this is sort of the hallmark of Human Rights Watch reports, that it contains the actual voices of people who've been abused. You know, but then, and obviously they can be hard to get at for all of the reasons that you've just suggested, and so often sort of building those networks and those kinds of relationships takes a very long time. But then trying to be very careful about cross-checking what we've been told with a lot of other sources to make sure that it's accurate, mostly because, you know, we may not get a response out of the Chinese government when we put out a report, but boy, if we're caught out being wrong on something, we hear about it very quickly. You know, as an institutional matter, as a methodological one, we tend to err on the side of caution, you know, particularly in written documents, but I think we often assume that problems are likely to be bigger or more serious, partly because we know, you know, it's not an open environment in which people can speak about what's happened to them. I don't know if that quite answers your question.
I think, again, it's about, we say self-censorship, but and we all practice self-censorship, you know. I mean, I don't write everything I know or things I would like to say because in case I offend somebody, you know. So we do all practice. So then how do we know we are not self-censoring our views? Is it just only the bad Chinese who self-censor, or then we don't? You know, is it self-censorship is evident in any kind of work? So that is what value judgment, that's what we teach our students to analyze and look at the works in that same rigorous sort of analysis we carry on works written by State Department officials about their life in there. You know, I would say, okay, we have to analyze everything. We cannot take it for face value. What level of self-censorship in there? I would use all the rigors of my sort of intellectual training or academic training to analyze the biography of State Department official as I would use to analyze a Chinese official. This is not something unique, peculiar in any situation in that. In a way, I found it analyzing Chinese self-censored document much easier to analyze. And the Tibetan official will write, in 1945, I was deluded by the imperialist propaganda, and I secretly colluded with the American imperialists, and I became CIA agent. So that is easy to read. I don't need whether he was deluded, he was 4 to 5, I read, okay, 4 to 5, he was working for the CIA. And so I took that information. I don't judge that whether he was deluded or misguided, and that doesn't matter. But when you read Western source, they don't say I was deluded. You know, it's hard to find where is the self-censorship. That is more tricky to analyze than from ones who is coming from communist China.
I would say the issue of censorship and self-censorship affects the whole field of what we know about religion in China, starting with the ban, internal secret ban on any academics in China writing about religion, Communist Party history, or the military. These are like three most sensitive issues somehow. And so even though there are internal surveys done among academics in China now for the first time in recent years, they can't easily publish the results or their interpretation of results and so forth. So much of what we know in this whole field becomes anecdotal. We don't have good research done on this. I think probably scholars of Chinese society tend to avoid writing about religion because it's so sensitive. I know for a fact that one scholar who was trying to get funding from a major U.S. foundation from their office in Beijing for a project to educate Chinese academics in how to do social science research on religion was told flatly, we don't fund anything to do with religion. It's probably because they figure they couldn't stay in Beijing. Their office would be out, you know. So, and I find myself worrying about what I say and how it's going to be interpreted, and I don't want to name names of people I know involved in China for fear of getting people in trouble that know me, you know. So this is a big problem as long as it's such a sensitive issue.
Right here. You.
Hi, I'm Aurora Carlson. I'm a grad student at SAIS. We all know that the Dalai Lama is getting on in his age, and I guess my question has to do with his passing on, especially if he does pass on outside of Tibetan or the Tibetan Plateau area. How likely do you think it is the Chinese government will continue the Dalai leadership, and if so, how they will prevent unrest in the Tibetan or religious communities?
If you look at any sort of policy indication from China and the statements they have made, it's quite evident that even in the event of Dalai Lama passing, the Chinese government will appoint its own Dalai Lama and willing to risk the wrath of the Tibetan people or the protest. But China, what is very important to China is not so much of the China. The question about Tibet in China is power and authority is the main concern. China must demonstrate its authority over Tibet and power over Tibet. And that is key to China. If you have Tibetan people protesting or doing things, it's not really a big problem for China because they can always can manage control. But China's problem of Tibet is always has been about legitimacy and authority. And this is what China must demonstrate. That's why China resorts to, I mean, where in China government initiates a policy by resorting to law developed during the Qing period. Say, you know, Qing emperor did this, therefore Shanghai, we will have this policy. But with Tibet, they say Qing emperor did this, and so this is the policy. So they always resort to history. One of the things we do legitimize things about Tibet is through history. So China always reverts to history and to demonstrate its continuity. Another thing they're trying to do is show continuity of Chinese rule in Tibet. So that is very important. And what the rest of the world thinks of that as negative, it really doesn't matter as long as this is demonstrated to the Chinese populace to show the Chinese government presence in Tibet is continuous, legitimate, and the government has power to do that. So that is most important. So it is Chinese are addressing the Chinese populace. not the world, not America or the Tibetan.
I would like to just add that the party state authorities in China are still very much claiming to be the ultimate moral authority in China and cultural authority in China, not just political authority in China. And so I noticed this even in new controls on online videos that were published on April 2nd. A few things crept in that, they're trying to diminish the harmful political or religious online videos as well as pornographic videos and such. And they want to enhance the building and management of an internet culture so as to disseminate the advanced culture of socialism. See, that has to be the majority culture in China, socialism. And they want to make sure evil cults and superstitions are not spread through internet videos. And it's interesting that they talk about videos that distort Chinese culture, Chinese history, and historical facts. The state is the ultimate arbiter of how history is determined and defined in China. So to them, it doesn't seem strange for them to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the liberation of Tibet, in quote marks, by having their choice of the Panchen Lama preside. I mean, it's an example of their effort to play favorites among the different sects in Buddhism, in Tibetan Buddhism, so that it's the Panchen Lama or some other Karmapa Lama, as opposed to the Dalai Lama, who they're trying to lift up as a competing authority. And this is the problem for Catholic Christians in China, because there is another ultimate authority over Catholics worldwide, and the Chinese don't have control over the Pope. So this creates a special political problem for Chinese Catholics.
Let's see. I want to get somebody sort of toward middle here.
Two quick questions.
The microphone. There we go.
Two quick questions. We're talking about deep strains in identity, and we're talking about how one aligns identity with allegiance. In other words, what a community says about itself as what it is, as opposed to some larger construct over which it has less control that is usually a national entity like China. Mm-hmm. So in this context of religion, and particularly appropriate when discussing Tibet, do you think that there's really any prospect? I'm asking all three panelists. Do you think there's any prospect that May 4th style thinking will actually have some currency and that there'll be some sort of pragmatic dialogue developing over the next 10 years, let's say, that addresses historical traditional concerns within mainstream Chinese society about separatism and so on, identities that as in the immortal non-English word splitism introduces to the current dialogue in Beijing? My second question is, and speaking specifically of the Catholic tradition, about which precious little has been said today, the early Jesuits, for those who've read the Sextans of Beijing, the huge impact that the early Jesuits had in the late Ming and early Qing periods, and the heirs of that still exist. For example, some of the large Chinese weaving families from Shanghai that now live primarily in Taiwan. What is the Taiwan Catholic-Christian connection in modern China?
Jen?
Taiwan? You start. Talk about Tibet.
Yes. It's very hard to say what sort of a discourse will emerge in China about religion, because when you look at most of like Charter 07 or Charter 08 and all this intellectual discourse, they're still dominated by legacy of May 5th. It is about modernization. And actually religious plays a very insignificant role on Chinese intellectual discourse. It's always about modernity in the West. So religion really has no sort of, I haven't seen a major sort of intellectual production from China writing which talks about religion, place of religion. We need religion, you know. There isn't been that. Whereas the Buddhism has been talked about in Taiwan or Catholicism, it's always to do with the family history or tradition rather than of providing a sort of really fundamental new paradigm for discussion of well, morality or social change. So it's still the Chinese discourse, intellectual discourse, is dominated by the May 5th movement, I think.
I can take a little bit of a stab at the first question, which is that I think the more philosophical debates aside, the most optimistic discussions I can imagine would go a little something like this. There would be a greater recognition on the part of the central government that relatively few people in different religious communities that are thought of as having separatist tendencies have actually really advocated for being separatists. What they, you know, that when it comes down to it, I think the most common articulation is either for real respect of formal autonomy, as it's spelled out in some of the autonomy laws, or simply for, you know, the latitude to practice religion in daily life as people want to. And that from the perspective, I think, of probably quite a few ordinary Uyghurs or Tibetans, you know, to simply leave that realm of people's lives alone, for the state to not intrude on that. And that from the central government's perspective, a discussion like that is at least that it buys its way out of, you know, a couple of serious headaches without having to really be supportive of religion, without having to appear to back off on some of the criticisms of different groups. But even that, I think, is a pretty optimistic, maybe too sunshiny hope.
I think the dynamics of globalization has been the strengthening of identities and loyalties that are both global or universal, like world religions, and local, ethnic group and local community identities, and the weakening of loyalty and identity, you know, applied to the nation state. This is a worldwide trend, and that's really what's happening in China. The nation state, the party state, has lost its ability to enforce that, you know, monolithic national identity for everybody, loyalty to the party that should take precedence over all your other loyalties and relationships. And the effort to try to prevent that from spinning off into serious, you know, political problems for the current system is behind their fears and their worries. I would agree there's really not many groups in China promoting political separatism, but trying to press directly and indirectly for autonomy, for more freedom, for managing their own affairs as local communities. And that's true of local governments as much as anybody. So I think personally that there's an easy solution to the Taiwan reunification issue and Hong Kong issue and Tibet. If there's, you know, a confederation of sorts down the line in the future, I think a lot of these problems, including economic problems, could be mitigated. But we're very far from there in the current situation.
Yeah, I think we have time for a couple more questions. Sir.
Thank you. My name is Peter Gluck. I'm not affiliated. I have a two-part question, but both parts center around the efforts of our government to promote, substantively beyond rhetoric, freedom of religious belief and practice in China. First of all, how would you assess, let's say, Clinton and Bush 43 and what they did? And secondly, do you have any concern that the priorities of dealing with the Chinese government for the Obama administration on matters like currency and debt and North Korea might push any interest they have to a relatively low priority.
Sophie, I know you're dying to talk. Go ahead.
Yes, and that one's mine. Well, I think, for starters, although the Clinton and Bush administrations, I think, had very different, there were sort of different rhythms and different strategies, at least in their minds, about promoting religious freedom in China. I wouldn't say that one was necessarily more successful than the other. And I think that's partly because the calculations are not necessarily made along lines where they're going to land the greatest punch in Beijing or get the best audience, to put it in a slightly more positive way. I think there's a lot of... I mean, I'm generally very critical of U.S. administrations in general and human rights in China, but you know, there's a lot of inconsistency that gives the Chinese government room to maneuver their way out of talking about certain issues. I think that 9 times out of 10, religious freedom gets discussed in very specific, particular settings, and is really not discussed in any other venues, particularly ones that are of more interest to the Chinese government. Effectively, winds up ghettoizing the issue. You know, and then you have, I mean, just look at Tibet over the last, say, 18 months or so, where the Dalai Lama comes to Washington and is given, a big deal award as a religious leader, not as a political one, right? And the administration goes way out of its way to make sure it's making that distinction. The payback the Chinese demand is that the president or what the administration offers up in part so that the Chinese are not so mad about this is that President Bush will go to the Olympics, where he goes yet again to the same house church, and almost completely ignores a very sort of, I would say, thoroughgoing effort on the part of the government to take the opportunity of the Olympics as a pretext to crack down on quite a few different religious groups about which the administration has virtually nothing to say. You know, you could excuse the Chinese government for being able to say, even if they wanted to seriously talk about the issue, to say, what? You do this thing, but not that thing. You're critical in those circumstances, but not these. It's a very inconsistent position. And I think that's why it's important to talk about all religions, to try to talk about it in a number of different settings. And, in my perfect world, U.S. administrations and other governments that claim to care about human rights shouldn't just confine these discussions, for example, to bilateral human rights dialogues. They should be talking about, I will be a happy, happy woman when... the strategic economic dialogue includes a discussion when they're talking, about issues like government transparency or product safety. And there they have a discussion about censorship of domestic press in China. Because it's just as relevant in those discussions as it is as a sort of pure human rights abuse, but it only gets discussed in the human rights dialogues. And I think that's a problem. Until the U.S. government and others talk about human rights in a much more sort of thoroughgoing way and in different venues, it's very easy for the Chinese government essentially to just duck the issue.
I worked in the State Department under 4 or 5 different administrations, and my observation is that they all kind of come down to the same China policy. I mean, there are certain ways you have to deal with China on more and more important issues in the world. The relationship has increasingly become more and more complex with lots of issues on the table at any given time that have to be balanced. This year, what is the most important among these all equally important issues? And frankly, I would have been, as an American taxpayer and an American citizen, I would have been very upset with Secretary Clinton if she wasn't talking to Chinese about the economic problems we face in the world or about North Korea. The federal government has a certain role to play in our society. It isn't in charge of everything. And if the Chinese hear about religious freedom from top diplomats and American officials, which they do whenever there are summits at that level, but don't hear about religious freedom issues from religious leaders from America that go to China and deal and work with China, or economic leaders or other kinds of civic leaders that go to China. I think, you know, they should take it with a grain of salt. It seems to me that American religious leaders should be out in front on this issue themselves, directly with the Chinese. And I just feel like people forget that the federal government wasn't given by the Constitution control over every issue that concerns Americans.
Okay, one final question. How about the young lady in red there? Is there a microphone for her?
Thank you. I'm a student from Fudan University in China, and I have a follow-up question for Falun Gong. My view about why our government is so tough about it is that the group leader Li Hongzhi portrayed himself as God. In this way, he can easily manipulate and control many people's minds, even to go against the government. This is partly why our government is claiming that this group is a terrorist or evil group instead of a religious group. Do you agree with this, and do you think the government has the right to define whether it is a religious group or not? If it doesn't, who does have the right to define? Thank you.
Sorry, I didn't quite get the last part of the question.
Who has the right to define what is a religious group? No. Government doesn't.
I mentioned that the Chinese government still does hold on to its authority as a moral arbiter. And so up till now, they have defined certain world religions as authorized to exist and operate in China. Protestant and Catholic dealt with as two separate religions. And Muslims and Buddhists and Taoists. Increasingly, that doesn't fit reality, even in China, where there are new religious movements rising up. There are other religious movements coming from outside that don't fit, such as Orthodoxy in the Northeast, or Christian Science, or Mormons. People who are studying and traveling overseas from China may come back as an adherent of one of those religions not authorized in China. And so this is what the government is trying to wrestle with. Should it change the definition? Should it add folk faith to the authorized religions or not? And the problem is that according to international standards, a group of people who define themselves as a religious group are a religious group. I mean, it's up to people to decide if they're a religion or not a religion. And the main point being that the state should protect the rights of all individuals to freedom of religion and belief, whatever that belief, and allow them to practice their beliefs, whether they're religious beliefs or even other beliefs, non-religious, anti-religious beliefs. And so the current Chinese mindset and structure is quite far from the international norms on this issue.
Okay, well, I think really we don't have any time left. I'm sorry that we don't. You've been a terrific audience. You've asked extremely incisive questions, but I think we ought to give our panelists a round of applause. Thank you for coming.